This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers
peace,
in
peace, freedom, and the American way. And all of a sudden, Chris, I am hearing my own voice with about a two-second delay in my own headphones. So if you could do something about that, it would be much appreciated. And yes, Sudan setting up new round of death. This is from Nicholas Kristof, in his new column. And by the way, that just started about halfway, about a minute into the show. The Sudanese government started the first genocide. The Sudanese government started the first genocide of the 21st century in Darfur, and now it seems to be preparing to start the second here among the thatched roof huts of southern Sudan. What a mess. Nick Kristof in here. I'm talking to this yesterday's New York Times. The front page story of yesterday's New York Times, scorched earth strategy returns to Darfur. They're showing this burned, you know, just absolutely trashed village. And, what a disaster. What an absolute disaster. On our website, if you go to TomHartman.com, you can find a link. We're heading out to Darfur a week from today. I'll be on the air Monday, 1 week from today, and then after I get off the air, we're heading out to the airport, and I'm hopping on a plane to Zurich, and they're meeting with Joe Madison, who's going to be on our program in about 30 minutes, and Rusty Humphries, a conservative talk show host, and two other talk show hosts who I don't personally know, doing local shows, one in Minneapolis and the other I'm not sure where, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, and with the head of the charity, Christian Solidarity International, that's putting this thing together. And we're going to fly down to Nairobi, Kenya. And then apparently instead of going into Nairobi because of all the fighting that's going on in Kenya right now, and there's 100,000 people displaced, about 1,000 people dead as a result of the battles over the stolen elections in Kenya about 4 weeks ago, we will be staying at the airport and then picking up a Russian cargo plane where my seatbelt is going to be the rope that ties me to the rib of the inside of the plane, if everything I hear is right. And we're going to head into Darfur. Should be interesting. So, anyhow, we'll get back to that. And we're going to have an interesting day today. Christopher Quine is going to be coming in our second hour. We're going to be talking about the economics of war. Always a fascinating topic. And in our third hour, we're going to be talking about the political director of the AFL-CIO, what they're doing and where they're at. Of course, tomorrow, the big primaries, Vermont, Rhode Island, Ohio, and Texas. What's up with that? What's going to be happening with that? Warren Buffett is now saying, okay, this is it. We are in a recession. Ain't no doubt about it. It's happening. It's real. It's here. It's now. And get used to it. Words to that effect. He's talking on CNBC's Squawk Box this morning, their show. And here is Warren Buffett, or maybe not. Apparently not. I'm not hearing it play into my... here we go. Maybe that.
Yeah, well, gross GDP is going up. Beyond that, I would say by any common sense definition, we are in a recession. We haven't had two consecutive quarters of GDP growth, but I will tell you that on balance, most people's situation, certainly their net worth has been heading south now for a considerable period of time. And if you owned a house and you had an 80% mortgage on it, and so you had 20% equity a year, you may not have any equity now. And millions of people are in positions somewhat similar to that, and people that own municipal bonds feel poorer today than they did.
Yeah, and on it goes. Bottom line, Warren Buffett, the smartest man in the world when it comes to investing, if results are any indicator, a very wise fellow, saying, yeah, we're in a recession. Some interesting pieces in the Washington Post, excuse me, in the Financial Times today about this that I want to get into in this first hour today. But first, I want to start out with the idea, my book of the month, my BuzzFlash book of the month, and I wrote this op-ed last week, and Mark Harlan of BuzzFlash has put it up, and you can find it over at BuzzFlash.com. And it's a review, more or less. I mean, it's also it's mostly a Tom Hartman rant, but, wrapped into a review of Ha Jun Chang's new book, Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism. And in that, he goes back to Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury under George Washington, the very first Secretary of the Treasury. Thomas Jefferson was Secretary of State, and so on. And Hamilton laid out this thing with the help, actually, of Tench Cox, who longtime listeners have heard me rant about in the past, talk about Cox, arguably our first lobbyist. You know, the first, he was not elected to anything, but he had a big say in the economics of this nation. And Hamilton and Cox had this vision for America, this plan for America, that which Jefferson, by the way, didn't share. This is one of those areas where I disagree with Jefferson. He wasn't always right on everything. He wasn't perfect on everything. And Jefferson thought America would be strongest if we maintained ourselves over the long term as an agriculture and agrarian society. Now, I think Jefferson was right in that if a society ever reaches the point where it can't feed itself, it can no longer call itself independent or free and finds itself at great risk. We have not reached that point, although we're getting awful close to it right now. But nonetheless, I mean, we're still exporting food. Depends on how you define food and you know, what the kind and qualities of food. But the larger issue is this issue of infant industries. Now, this is a phrase that everybody says was invented in the 1840s. I think it's 1841. Friedrich List. Was writing about how the German government should be protecting industries, infant industries, and helping them grow. But in fact, it was in the 1790s that Alexander Hamilton submitted this report to Congress. It was called Report on the Subject of Manufactures. And in his report, he basically laid out a series of things that need to be done in order to build a successful nation. This is not rocket science. There were 11 of them. And I'll tell you what they were very simply. Number one, protecting duties. In other words, a tax on the import of foreign manufactured goods to incur. Here's his words. Protective duties are duties on those foreign articles which are the rivals of the domestic ones intended to be encouraged. By enhancing the charges on foreign articles, they enable the national manufacturers to undersell all their foreign competition. That's the first thing he said we should do. And we did that, and then he goes on through the rest of the list, prohibition of rival articles or duties equivalent to prohibitions. In other words, if you've got other companies that are competing with you, you know, you should prevent their stuff from coming into the country. Now, this is what, in the 1940s, 1948, there was a company that was manufacturing looms. They were making looms and fabric. And this company was located in had no, for all practical purposes, no domestic auto industry. This company decided to go into the car business. The government nurtured them. The Ministry of Industry and Trade said, okay, we're going to help you out. We're going to support you in doing this. They set up huge tariffs, very high tariffs. In fact, General Motors and Ford were both doing business in that country. And in the 1940s, they threw General Motors and Ford out of the country. Said, sorry, you can't even do business in our country. Can't be done. And the result of this was that this little loom company, this clothing manufacturing company that was started in 1933 to decided that they were going to make cars, it was at that time known as the Toyota Loom Company, and today the Toyota Automatic Loom Company, and today is Toyota, which manufactures the Lexus that Tom Friedman so famously said, this is the wonderful thing, this car, the Lexus, this is a demonstration of the wonders of free trade and non-protectionism. Well, I'm sorry, in every case in every country in the history of the world. Countries that went from being relatively undeveloped to being developed, countries that went from unsuccessful economies to successful economies, did it through one simple means: protecting their domestic industries, using tariffs. We had tariffs from the founding of this country up until the 1980s. 1973, our average tariff was 12%. Now our average tariff is 2%. And guess what's happened? Off go our jobs. So Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama in Ohio talking about jobs. Frankly, in my opinion, they should be talking about tariffs as well. A lot. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and supporting your local affiliate, putting their bumper stickers on your car, telling your friends, hey, listen to, you know, fill in the blank. And also, of course, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. So I'm going to very, very quickly go through the 11 items that Alexander Hamilton said you have to have a decent economy, which we did have in this country until Ronald Reagan came along and started dismantling this stuff. Number one, protecting duties. Number two, prohibitions of rival articles or duties equivalent to prohibitions. Number three, prohibitions on the exportation of the materials of manufacture. In other words, don't give away your raw materials. We are now, by the way, the world's largest exporter of raw materials. We're giving this stuff away at pennies on the dollar. Number four, pecuniary bounties. This is a fancy way of saying give subsidies to the small and emerging industries. Number five, premiums. These are incentives for production, innovation, or quality. Number six, the exemption of the materials of manufacture from duty. In other words, when you bring raw materials into the country, you do not charge duties on those. Number eight, the encouragement of new inventions and discoveries. In other words, patents and copyrights. Number nine is judicious regulation for the inspection of manufactured commodities. In other words, regulations and inspections to make sure your quality is good. Number 10, the facilitation of pecuniary remittances. In other words, a stable currency and banking system. And number 11, the facilitating of the transportation of commodities. In other words, a transportation infrastructure, rails and roads, and in the modern day airlines, airports and things. It's just very straightforward stuff. This is not rocket science. We're going to have Joe Madison at the bottom of the hour. Let's get a couple of calls in here. And Bob in San Jose, California, 866-303-2270. Hey, Bob, what's up?
The reason why I called was my wife and I got married in 1968. We had a 10-year-old car. In 1972, we decided we had to replace that thing. And we literally could not find a car that we felt was built very well. They were, at that point, cars were being designed literally to fall apart at 4 years of age. And we ended up buying a Volvo, which we had for the next 14 years and 180,000 miles.
Yeah.
We really didn't want to buy an imported car, but the difference in quality was radical.
I know. And in part, and having grown up in Michigan, and, you know, I mean, we're on the air in three different stations in Michigan, in Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Grand Rapids, and I know that a lot of our Michigander listeners are very on this. I remember the time in the 70s when there were banners over the highways. People would hang these kind of like flag-like banners and bumper stickers that said, you know, buy an import car, put an American out of work.
We remember that, too.
Two things happened, Bob. The first was that Detroit, in my humble opinion, now I'm not, you know, wasn't privy to any of these conversations, but Detroit, in my humble opinion, decided that they would engineer cars to have a relatively limited lifestyle. Now, that said, I should say my dad always drove Buicks, you know, he worked in a machine shop, a tool and die shop, Lansing Die Sinking in Lansing, that supplied to General Motors, and he was very loyal to General Motors. And he always bought a Buick, and he always got 100,000 miles on it before he gave it to one of his grandkids, who would get another 100,000 miles on it. So, you know, General Motors actually did make good cars. It's just that
somewhere in the mid-60s, I think, is when they decided to not make good cars.
Yeah, and the other problem that the American automakers had that the foreign automakers didn't have is that they were spending thousands of dollars on health care. and other expenses. And it's become a mess. But yeah, Bob, we've tried too. I mean, I'm driving a Toyota Prius right now, and I wish that there was an American manufacturer that made a car that did the same thing and did it as well. I really wish there was. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott.
Good morning, Tom. That cruise was fantastic.
Hey, it was great to see you on the Air America cruise last week.
Thank you. It was great to be able to speak with you in person, and it was also great to hear you guys being able to go on a little bit longer than the radio segments would allow you to, and especially happy that the FCC wasn't there all the time.
Yeah, there you go. We had a great time. Scott, thanks a lot for the call and for your kind words. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Greetings, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Tom, I have a philosophical question just about economics in general, since mm-hmm. there's so many decisions about it. Now, I'm a little bit prejudiced. I'm a student of biology, and it's all my master's in, but is economics really a science? I mean,
no.
We put people like Milton Friedman and whatever on the same platitude as Einstein and Jonas Salk,
yeah.
was one of my heroes. Do they belong to be there? And what
no, not in my opinion. Economics, in my opinion, is not a science. There are some fundamentals of economics that you can quantify, and you can say, you know, yes, when you do this, this is what happens. But because economic policy is so intertwined with social policy and political policy, the economics of, the libertarian economics of the Sudan, for example, or the kleptocratic, actually, economic politics of the northern Sudan, versus the social democratic or socialist politics, economics of Sweden, versus the semi libertarian economics of the United States. I mean, all of them actually operate by different rules. And they operate by different rules in part because they have different infrastructure, they have different natural resource bases, they have different social assumptions, social economies. And so to say, oh yeah, Milton Friedman's got it all figured out, or John Maynard Keynes has got it all figured out, or any of them, to say that, I think is a terrible mistake. I, James, excellent question. In my humble opinion, and I say that I sat next to Paul Krugman on, and we did a panel together. Paul, forgive me, but in my opinion, economics is not a science. It is part art, mostly art, and part science. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, maybe here, but certainly not in Darfur. Joe Madison, also known as the Black Eagle by his Radio 1 WLAM listeners in Washington, D.C., nationally on XM Satellite Radio Channel 169, one of America's top talk radio personalities. My old friend Dick Gregory, who actually the last time I went to Africa, Dick Gregory went with me in 1981. We went into Uganda together after the war with Idi Amin. He said, you can't pigeonhole the Black Eagle. Joe Madison is more than a radio talk host. He's a radio activist. In 1974, he was named to the board of directors of the NAACP at the age of 24. Joe Madison, I am honored to have you on our program.
Well, my honor really is. I, as I was telling you earlier, I get up early in the morning, and I get a chance to listen to Tom Hartman. So I sort of set my show topics to what you talked about the night before.
Oh, bless you, Joe. Thank you.
So
it's great to have you on.
It's always good, and it's going to be good to be with you also, I guess, next week, a week from today.
Yeah, we are. You and I are meeting in Switzerland on Tuesday morning, and we're going to hop on a plane down to Nairobi, Kenya, where I understand that because of the fighting, instead of going into town and getting visas and doing all that kind of stuff, we're just going to have to stay out at the airport?
Yeah, we're going to have to do that, unfortunately. But now we're finding out that there's going to be some hot spots, Tom, in southern Sudan. Mm-hmm. I just had on my show this morning Congressman Donald Payne, who is known as Mr. Africa. He just got back from the very region and territories that we're going, and he had talked to Salva Kiir, who is the Sudan's senior vice president, and he's also the territory president of southern Sudan, and they anticipate that there might be war breaking out. And the New York Times just did a story that's actually on the web saying that there's been a violation of the Comprehensive Peace Act that was signed back in 2005. And everybody now is arming themselves.
Let me give a little backstory to our listeners who may not be familiar with this, and please correct me if I have any of this wrong, Joe. Sudan, a country, a fairly large country. We're talking it's a couple times the size of Texas, in fact.
Yeah, it's the largest landmass country on the continent of Africa.
Right. And the northern part of Sudan is principally Arab and Muslim. The southern part of Sudan is principally Black African and Christian and animist. And
right.
and the British, I guess, ruled that region, and they never bothered to develop the southern part. The northern part is fairly well developed with roads and cities and things, and the south is there's no roads, there's no buildings, there's no hotels, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And although there's a lot of people.
I mean, one of their problems, they are hamstrung with the relative inaccessibility. The roads are connecting, to the territory in Kenya's port of Mombasa, but you hit it right on the area. In addition to that, you've got literally millions of refugees who fled or were taken as slaves during the 20-plus civil war that are now coming back. Many of them in preparation for a referendum calling for independence, I think, in 2010.
Right.
But they're coming back to nothing. And I mean absolutely nothing.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say this is land that the scrub high desert of northern Arizona and parts of New Mexico makes look lush.
Yes, in a way. One of the things that we're doing is delivering thousands of sacks of hope.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that will be fish hooks. There'll be seeds for planting. But part of the problem is that the refugees who return, Tom, they can't go back to their land because they haven't been cleared of landmines. In addition to that, they just simply are people who are starving to death. And the terrible thing is that southern Sudan has more oil than northern Sudan. The government of northern Sudan gets 100% of all the oil that is found along a demarcation line, and they get 100% of any oil discovered north of that line. They get 50% of all the oil that is discovered south of that line. The only problem is because people live the way they did 400 years ago, there is no way of keeping track of how much oil is being found. And the people who are keeping track of the oil happen to be, get this, the Chinese,
right,
who are in bed with the northern Sudanese.
Right, and arming the Janjaweed and the northern Sudanese. And this is why Steven Spielberg pulled out of the Olympics.
That's exactly, and Mia Farrow is in the process, who, matter of fact, just emailed me, and I sent you an email because she just got back on the same mission with Congressman Donald Payne, and she had talked to Salva Kiir, and she was telling me to pass along to our delegation that it is just terrible there, just absolutely terrible, and that Salva Kiir, who will have a chance to talk with, I'm hoping, in Juba, is saying that he anticipates that there might be war, and it would make Darfur, which is in the western part of Sudan, look like a walk in the park.
Right, the western part of southern Sudan, by and large.
Correct. And then the Nubas, the Nubians in the Nuban mountain region, which we won't get a chance to go to, they're having problems with the government because the government there is trying to control the rivers. They want to build a dam. Who's building the dam? The Chinese. And what are they going to do? Flood the Nubian mountain region, which would destroy all of the historical artifacts, some of the first pyramids that were built. It would literally eliminate the culture and the history of the Nubian people.
Yeah, I think most people don't realize there's over 400 pyramids in Sudan that date back before the Egyptian civilization.
You got it, Tom. This will be my fourth visit, but the key was to get people like yourself and a delegation of talk show personalities to do two things. One, raise money for these sacks of hope. They're $50 each. They provide tarp so that folks can put them over their huts or use them as ground cover. Mosquito nets, malaria is on the rise. Fish hooks because they can fish. You teach them to fish, they'll feed themselves. A mallet, sorghum seed, sickle, things like a 5-gallon water jug because they have to walk miles. So we deliver thousands of these in a cargo plane. But in addition to that, we'll be able to come back. And now's the time to get the Bush administration to do something. See, Donald Payne said today that Bush has about 11 months to clear this situation up. Remember, Bill Clinton said the worst problem, the most thing he regretted during his administration, he did nothing when it came to the genocide in Rwanda.
Right.
Well, that lasted for 100 days, and almost a million people were killed in that genocide. The situation in southern Sudan and Darfur, of course, Darfur has been going on for 5 years. And so here's an administration that has absolutely been unable to convince the Bashir government to quit stop these atrocities that they have been creating all over this country. One, in the West, they want the land. Two, in the South, they want the oil. Three, in the Nubian Mountain, they want the water.
Right, and the Chinese are in bed with both of them. We're talking with Joe Madison, the Black Eagle, who is flying with me and Rusty Humphreys and Ellen Ratner and a couple of other talk show hosts into Darfur next week. We're leaving here after I get off the air on Monday. We're going to all converge in Switzerland and fly down to Nairobi, and then from there, I guess
we're going to... And actually, the correction, we'll actually go in to Juba and the southern part of Sudan, and then right, hopefully, to the border of Darfur.
Right.
The question of trying to get in Darfur is a chancy one, let me say that, for the lack of
we'll be taking this stuff right up to the refugee camps.
And
we're going to be flying in the back of a cargo plane, strapped to the ribs of the plane instead of having seat belts.
Oh, the last time Sherry, my wife and I went... I mean, it was like a cargo plane with thousands of sacks of hope, and it was one of the oldest, raggediest cargo planes that we could find. And yeah, man, it's like it's not like you're flying on one of the airlines and you're strapped in. I mean, you basically tie a rope around you and you pray that you land safely. You get there, people come out. It will give you an entirely different perspective of what's going on in that part of the world and how we've got to stand up and speak out. Thank God I heard Obama finally say something about in the last debate, and we got to get all the other candidates talking about it and get everybody focused on this.
I agree. Well, we'll talk again about this later on in this week, Joe. Joe Madison, the Black Eagle, joemadison.com is website. If you want a link to CSI International, it's on my homepage, tomhartman.com. If you want to donate $50 for a sack of hope to help out for Joe and my trip. Joe, thanks so much for being with us today.
And we'll talk in Zurich and then on to Sudan.
Yeah. I look forward to spending a week with you, Joe.
Okay,
and
Tom.
Thank you for coming on our program today and helping raise consciousness of this.
God bless, man.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Joe Madison, joemadison.com is website. The Black Eagle, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman program.
And let me add, we will be doing our show live from the southern Sudan on Friday. The satellite phone, God's willing, as we're flying through Europe and into Africa. On Tuesday, I believe Sam Cedar is going to be filling in for me. Wednesday and Thursday will be Laura, and then on Friday, Carl Wolfson will be here. And but if we can get a satellite phone working, I'll be doing the show here Friday from Africa. And then we're flying home Monday and Tuesday. Peter B. Collins is going to be filling in for us from the Take Back America conference in Washington, D.C. So it's a long haul to get into some of these regions. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Tom?
I am Tom. You are Mike.
Tom, I get the Mother Jones magazine, and last week there was this article about this guy that went undercover down where all this killing's going on down in Darfur. He did was he got all the serial numbers from all the a lot of the weaponry that's doing all this killing, and these serial numbers were all traceable back to China.
Yeah, I know.
And then in the article, they also mentioned oil. And so if there's one thing all your listeners should be aware of, and that was a point Joe Madison, your previous guest, just mentioned, was about the control of the oil.
Yeah, this is all about, ultimately, is that there's oil in the South and the guys in the North want it, and you can't pump oil out of, you know, the middle of a village without the consent of the villagers. So they're destroying the villagers. They're going through and killing them. And it's the Chinese who are driving it. And it's also that we can get cheap stuff at Walmart. I mean, that's the bottom line. Mike, thank you for pointing that out. I'll have to go looking for that Mother Jones article. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. William in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, William, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Now, what's on my mind is the gold standard and monetary policy. You were mentioning earlier in the show the economics of the founding fathers, and I'd just like to mention for a second that Thomas Jefferson said pretty clearly that if central banks allow central banks to have the issuing power of currency, then we're going to wake up homeless on the land our fathers conquered. Essentially, I mean, that's how I see today's situation.
Yeah, that was his debate with...
You have a recession created by inflation, essentially.
Well, I think actually our recession has been created... William, I'm sorry, your phone's breaking up pretty badly. I would say that our recession has been created by two major factors. One is conservative economic trade policies or conservative economic policies that dislabors, that have disempowered labor in the United States, and that have done away with protective tariffs that protect American industries. So, number one, we have hollowed out the core, the industrial core of the United States, and that is leading to a recession. And then, number two, we have a war-based economy, and we have, frankly, since Vietnam. We've had this war-based economy where we do these wars, and we borrow money like crazy to pay for it, and then when the bill comes due, as it did during the Jimmy Carter administration, and during the first couple of years of the Reagan administration, frankly, you know, Reagan had the most serious recession since the Great Depression. And it was the result of having to pay back the money that was borrowed to fund Vietnam by both LBJ and Nixon. And we're going to see the same thing. And I think that those are the two big variables. Having the Fed say that they're willing to convert our currency into trash, if that will hold off a recession at least until November and at least until the elections, doesn't help any. And, in fact, that's what the world is looking at right now, and that's why gold is going through the roof and oil is going through the roof and everybody's freaked out about what are you going to do about the dollar. There's that. Craig in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to know if you saw on Friday where Chief Justice Roberts was bemoaning the fact that couldn't Exxon do more so that they wouldn't have to pay out these punitive damages.
Right. How can this company that showed a $40 billion profit in the last quarter, how could they, you know, be forced to pay $5 billion for the Exxon Valdez and all the destruction of communities and wiping out people's livelihoods? This is just a terrible thing. You got to keep in mind, Craig, and thank you for pointing this out, you've got to keep in mind that John Roberts was a corporate lawyer before he became the head of the Supreme Court. He had two things that distinguished him. One, during the year 2000, he went down to Florida and he prepped the lawyers because he used to work for Rehnquist as his clerk. So he went down to Florida and he prepped the lawyers on the Bush side for when Bush sued Gore before the Supreme Court in the Bush v. Gore case. He knew what kind of appeals would appeal to Rehnquist. He knew how to approach Rehnquist. He played the role of Rehnquist. And the lawyers argued in front of him in their practice sessions, the Republican lawyers. The Democratic lawyers did none of this kind of stuff. They just showed up. And so, number one, so he helped out George helped the, you know, with the coup, the Supreme Court coup that made George Bush president in the year 2000, number one. And number two, he was a multi-million dollar a year corporate lawyer. He made millions of dollars a year representing, you know, big corporations and the interests of big corporations. And so, of course, that made him, what do you call it? The good guy, I guess, for the Republicans. John in San Francisco. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I was listening to Joe Madison. You're interviewing with him, and he brought up Rwanda and the 100-day genocide.
Yeah.
And a comment from you bothered me late last year when there was a lot of talk about radio hosts and what they say. And you said you were entertained by Michael Savage Wiener. And I really had a problem with that because when I think of Rwanda, I think of a genocide that was perpetuated by a tribe of Hutus who took hold of the radio stations and for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, said, "Kill your enemy, the Tutsis."
Yeah, and here you've got Michael Savage now.
It's a bloodthirsty religion is practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
And he would say
sound
that.
Familiar?
He would say that about. Well, he does say that about Muslims every day if he
I
can.
Know. I know, I know. And so if
he's
if
a very
you,
dangerous person, and I just...
I don't disagree, and I point that out very often on this program, some of the outrageous things that he says and how they're not good for democracy, they're not good for America. The man is not a loyal American, in my opinion. I believe he's a traitor
he's
to this nation.
He's a criminal.
Well, I'm not going to call him a criminal, but I would say that he is not a supportive American, and he does an entertaining talk show, and that's the problem, frankly. Yeah, I mean, we've reached the point where we're saying, you know, that's not a value judgment. That's simply a statement of show business reality. And the problem is, just like with Father Coughlin, you get somebody who does that, and they're a demagogue, and they can be very dangerous. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program. Back from the Air America cruise, a week from now, heading off to Darfur, to southern Sudan. You can get the information, and if you want to help out in any way, over at tomhartman.com. What about this idea? The last time I went to Africa was 1981. I was in Uganda in 80 and 81 during the war with Idi Amin when the Tanzanians invaded, and we took over a refugee camp, the Namalo refugee camp, or the Namalo prison farm, actually, turned it into a refugee camp. And the program is still operating. In fact, you can find the information about that at saliminternational.org. And the second time I went back with Dick Gregory, who was on our board and is an old friend. And we were flying across the Atlantic in the middle of the night, and we'd had a couple of glasses of wine, and we were just telling stories. And he said, "You know what I don't get? What I don't get is why America thinks that it has to run around the world shoving democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun." He says, "When you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it." And, you know, it was a great joke. And apropos for introducing our next guest, Christopher J. Coyne is with us. He has a new book out, After War, The Political Economy of Exporting Democracy. His website, C-Coyne, C-O-Y-N-E.com. And Christopher is also the Associate Professor of Economics at West Virginia University. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you today?
Fine. Great to have you with us. I have spent a fair amount of time with your book and on your website, and I think that you and I share the diagnosis of the problem, much like Ron Paul does, that you know, invading states, knocking down states, shoving democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun, by and large, doesn't work. And I would submit to you that the reasons why Germany and Japan are somewhat different than you're saying, and I'd love to get your take on my take, but your bottom line is you're saying that the way to build democracy in a nation after you've knocked down a dictator is by principled non-intervention and unilateral free trade. In other words, get out of the way and just let the market do its magic. Am I paraphrasing you accurately?
Somewhat. I would argue actually that we shouldn't be going around the world knocking dictators out either, unless they're a direct threat to the United States.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
But generally you're right. The argument is exactly the joke, which has a lot of truth to it, is true. If people want something, they'll not steal it, but they'll adopt it themselves. And the idea is through trade we can expose people to these ideals.
Right. So in 1601, Queen Elizabeth I chartered the British East India Company, and with massive government subsidies built the largest industrial economy in the world over the next century and a half. The 120 years before that, the Dutch government, the kingdom, not the lower countries, but the official Holland, right out of Amsterdam, chartered the Dutch trading companies, heavy government subsidies, built a massive worldwide trading force. The Spanish did the same thing. In the 19th century, you saw the United States with tariffs that averaged throughout the entire 19th century 50%. Abraham Lincoln raised them from 45 to 50%, and they pretty much averaged 45 to 50% right up through World War, right up until 1921 when the Republicans came into office, dropped them down to 37%, and then after World War I they went back up to 45%. Smoot-Hawley actually took them from 38% to 43%. So we saw protectionism in the United States building an economy. After World War II, protectionism in the Japanese and German economies, building an economy. Can you name for me, please, one industrialized country in the world or one successful country in the world that has built itself from nothing, that is where it's having to compete with all the fully developed predatory powers of the world, whether they be corporate or governmental? One nation that has followed your prescription successfully? Because I just listed a whole bunch that did the exact opposite.
Sure. Well, let me just clarify one thing. Don't misunderstand my argument in the book. It's not that if we trade with people, all of a sudden, everyone's going to turn into an industrialized nation. But the argument in the book is that trade has, in addition to economic benefits, which I think you'd agree with, that trade does have some economic benefits.
Depends on the trade.
I'm sorry?
It depends on the trade.
Sure.
I think that if we're importing sandalwood from Thailand or wine from France, arguably that has a benefit because we don't make French wine and we don't carve sandalwood here. But if we're importing cars from Japan, and that's a heavily subsidized industry, and the Ministry of Industry and Trade is helping out the Japanese, or China, for example. China, if you want to export a car into China, it's 22% import tariff. If you want to import a car from China, 2% import tariff. I'd say that's not good trade.
Okay, well, the argument in the book is that trade also has a cultural element too. So I'm not so much making the argument that if we just trade with people, all of a sudden industrialized nations will emerge. It's that we, instead of pointing a gun at someone and saying, adopt democracy, adopt freedom or else, I'm saying exposing them to these ideals and values is the way to get them to adopt it. And the trade is one way of doing that.
Right.
There's two other very quick points. Don't confuse correlation with causation. So just because countries had tariffs and became wealthy doesn't mean it was because of the tariffs that they became wealthy.
Well, name a country that didn't. Name a country that became wealthy without tariffs. I don't think you can.
Well, and also remember, too, where a lot of tariffs come from. So the tension in your argument is, on the one hand, as you've done in your book, you argue against the role of corporations in lobbying government for handouts. Well, that's where a lot of the tariffs come from and why the tariffs get abused in many cases.
That was Hamilton's argument in his report on manufacturers in the 1790s to Congress, was that if you have infant industries in your country and you want them to survive the predations of mature industries in other countries, you're going to have the government intervene.
Sure, but remember that in many of these countries we're intervening, and it's not even an instance of infant industries, because the industries can't emerge because there's not even basic protections of property, respect for human rights, the basic institutions that you've been.
But Iraq had a mature economy before the Iraq War. Iraq had they had over 200 government-owned industries, but in addition to that, there were large chunks of the private sector that were working very successfully. Every single building in Iraq that were blowing up, they built themselves. They had an electrical infrastructure, they had a telephone infrastructure, they had all the physical, social, cultural, and political infrastructure that worked. We tore it apart, and L. Paul Bremer said, let's follow the libertarian path that Chris Coyne is suggesting. I mean, he didn't name you, but that you're suggesting in your book, and let's just get out of the way and let the free market do its work. And what do we have now? 60% unemployment, and they're shooting at us.
No, you're confusing things again. It's not blowing things up and then saying, well, free markets, right? That's not what happens, because free markets assume certain things. They assume well-defined property rights and an effective court system and police that are effective, and none of those things are in place. So it's unfair to blame the market for this. You should be blaming the government for basically trying to centrally plan the economy, which is really what they're trying to
do. But the title of your book is After War, The Political Economy of Exporting Democracy. And I'm suggesting to you that after war, when that infrastructure is damaged, is the time when, instead of having the libertarian free market go in and trust major corporations to make everything well and rebuild the infrastructure of the country, that's the very time when you need to do what Germany and Japan and the United States did after the War of 1776 and the War of 1812 and after the Civil War, arguably. And have government rebuild the infrastructure, both physical and social.
Sure. Well, one of the things to keep in mind is why, in, for instance, the cases of Germany and Japan, why the aid and the government was effective there in rebuilding things. Whereas you can't blame Iraq today for the fact that the corporations have contract to rebuild things. The reason it's not going well is because you build something and the next day it gets blown up. So it's fundamentally a security issue.
No, it's getting blown up because Paul Bremer did away with Iraqi domestic content laws, and he did away with all the tariffs and protections to trade. So it was possible for a company from the United States to come in and bring in labor from Sri Lanka, and more cheaply than a domestic Iraqi company that was less efficient and that had to pay decent wages to Iraqis, more efficient, at least in theory, build the buildings.
Yeah, I mean, look, these are very good arguments against government, because, of course, government, the U.S. government's the one that contracted with all these people.
Well, it's against our government, but these are strong arguments in favor of local and indigenous governments.
Yes, but see, that's exactly the point, non-intervention and free trade, so that what U.S. should be doing is allowing the Iraqis to rebuild it. So I don't understand why we're disagreeing here, right?
I'm agreeing with you that we should allow the Iraqis to rebuild. I'm disagreeing with you in that I'm saying the Iraqis should also be able to put back into place their tariffs and protectionist measures that help them build their country in the first place.
I don't disagree. Look, the Iraqis should be able to make their own decision. That's point of the argument. Part of the argument in the book is this issue of self-determination. The idea is, what can the United States do? And I think isolating the United States from these countries that we want to expose to Western values is a very bad strategy.
Yeah, this is why the embargo against Cuba has done nothing but help Castro,
yeah,
for example.
I mean, it's terrible. I mean, that's a perfect example of a terrible policy. And this, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but that's an example of bad trade barriers, I would think.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree. Absolutely. Christopher Coyne, the book After War, The Political Economy of Exporting Democracy. You can find more about it on his website at ccoyne.com. Assistant Professor of Economics at West Virginia University. Christopher, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got a letter from old George W. It said, son, I hate to trouble you, but this war of mine is going bad. It's time for me to roll those dice. I know you've already been there twice, but I am sending you back to Baghdad. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
Yes, indeed. Apparently what he's doing. 21 minutes past the hour. Well, you know, speaking of economics, very often on this program, every couple of months, actually, I try to be sure and share with you again a day in the life of Joe, middle-class Republican. John Gray of Cincinnati, Ohio, wrote this some years ago, and it's all over the Internet, easy to find. Day in the life of Joe Republican. And I want to share it with you again now because there's a sequel, which is absolutely brilliant. So here's the original, first of all. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. to prepare his morning coffee. He fills his pot full of good, clean drinking water because some liberal fought it for minimum water quality standards. He takes his daily medication with his first swallow of coffee. His medications are safe to take because some liberal fought to ensure their safety and that they work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance, and now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, eggs, and bacon. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some liberal fought for laws to regulate the meat packing industry. Joe takes his morning shower, reaching for his shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled with every ingredient and the amount of its contents because some liberal fought for his right to know what he was putting on his body and how much it contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some tree-hugging liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees. You see, some liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the right to be a contributor. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation, because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. If Joe is hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get workers' compensation or an unemployment check because some liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of temporary misfortune. It's noontime. Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay his bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system during the Republican Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some stupid liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. Joe gets home from work. He plans to visit his father that evening at their home, their farm out in the country. He gets in his car for the drive to Dad's house. His car is among the safest in the world because some liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home. He was the third generation to live in the house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't even have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Those rural Republicans would still be sitting in the dark. He's happy to see his dad, who's now retired. He lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. After his visit with Dad, he gets back in his car for a ride home, turns on the radio talk show. The host keeps saying, liberals are bad, conservatives are good. He doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout the day. Joe agrees. We don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. Okay, so that's a day in the life of Joe Republican. Then over at Craigslist, oddly enough, a person who, there's not a name on this, just an email address, posted this day in the life of a true conservative. Joe Conservative wakes up in the morning, goes to the bathroom. He flushes his toilet and brushes his teeth, mindful that each flush and brush costs him about 43 cents to his privatized water provider. His wacky liberal neighbor keeps badgering the company to disclose how clean and safe their water is, but no one ever finds out. Just to be safe, Joe Conservative boils his drinking water. Joe steps outside and coughs. The pollution is especially bad today, but the smokiest cars are the cheapest ones, so everyone buys them. Joe Conservative checks to make sure he has enough toll money for the three different private roads he must drive to work. There's no public transportation, so traffic is backed up, and his 10-mile commute takes an hour. On the way, he drops his 12-year-old daughter off at the clothing factory she works at. Paying for kids to go to private school till they're 18 is a luxury, and Joe needs the extra income. Times are hard, and there's no social safety net. He gets to work 5 minutes late and misses the call for Christian prayer and is immediately docked by his employer. He's not feeling well today, but he has no health insurance since neither his employer nor the government provide it, and paying for it himself is really expensive because he has a precondition. He just hopes for the best. His workday is 12 hours long because there's no regulation over working hours, and Joe will lose his job if he complains or unionizes. Today is an especially bad day. His manager demands that he works until midnight, a 16-hour day, but he does it because he knows he'll lose his job if he doesn't. Finally, after midnight, he picks up his daughter to go home. She shows him the deep cut she got on the industrial sewing machine today. He's outraged and asks why she doesn't have metal mesh gloves or other protection. She says the company won't provide it. She'd have to pay for it out of her own pocket. Joe looks at the wound and decides they'll use an over-the-counter disinfectant and bandage it until it heals. She'll have a scar, but getting stitches at the emergency room is expensive. His daughter also complains that the manager made suggestive overtures towards her. He counsels her to be a good girl and not rock the boat, or she'll get fired and they'll lose their income. His daughter says she can't wait until she's 18 to vote for change or go to the Iraq War. They get home and there's a message from his elderly father who can't afford to pay his medical or heating bills. Joe hears him coughing and shivering. Joe turns on the radio and the top story is a proposal in Congress to raise the voting age to 25. A rare liberal opinionator states it's an attempt to keep power out of the hands of working class Americans. The conservative host immediately quashes him, calling him a utopian idealist and agreeing that people aren't mature enough to make good choices until they're at least 25. Joe chuckles at the wine-swilling, cheese-eating liberal egghead and says, thank God I live in America where I'm free.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
Nope. No, siree, Bob. It's time for a change in America. And I don't mean that as a campaign slogan. I'm telling you, any Democrat at any presidential level, can Congress, Senate, House, well, you know, I guess there's a few. There's a couple of Joe Liebermans out there. But by and large, any Democrat is going to take this country back in the direction it needs to go. We have a small problem with fewer than 60 votes in the Senate and a razor-thin majority in the House that is not reflected by the number that doesn't. I think most people are unaware that that majority in the House is made up in large part of Democrats who are being elected out of Republican districts and are thus very, very, those are very shaky seats. So we need a landslide in this election. The bottom line, just voting isn't enough. I mean, that's just the absolute bottom line. By the way, quick heads up, at the top of the next hour, Dr. Louis Malmadrona is going to be here with us, the author of Coyote Healing, Coyote Wisdom, Coyote Medicine, a Native American physician, psychiatrist, an old friend. And Louis, we're going to talk about the state of healthcare in America today. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. Karen Ackerman from the AFL-CIO, she's the political director with the AFL-CIO, is going to be on to talk about the candidates' economic records. And Terry McAuliffe, the former chairman of the DNC, Democrats.org, and a superdelegate, is going to drop by. 36 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Andre in South Carolina. Hey, Andre, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Glad to speak with you.
Well, and thanks for listening there on AM 1230. What's up?
Well, I agree with you. Any non-interventionalist policies have to include and extend to the unregulated free market dogma as well. We can't import our idea of how their economic systems work. And what I've seen in reading is that we use institutions like the World Bank and the IMF to apply unfair advantage on countries.
Yeah, we do. The basic way it works is that you have a small country with a bunch of small companies in it that, you know, are emerging industries in an emerging nation. And if that country does not put up trade barriers to protect its infant industries, to use Alexander Hamilton's term, then what's going to happen is nearby countries are now in this day of, you know, jet travel and things, even possibly faraway countries, and their fully mature industries are just going to come in and eat their lunch. They're going to turn that country into basically a source for raw materials or a market, a consumptive market for their products. And if you want an example of that, look at what has happened in the United States in the last 30 years under Reaganomics.
Absolutely.
You know, we've got China Absolutely. Eating our lunch. And it's because we're pursuing these insane policies. Because when you get right down to it, everybody said, you know, the reason why Reagan and Clinton and Bush were all for pushing for NAFTA and WTO. And by the way, NAFTA is not the big problem. Big problem that nobody's willing to talk about is GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and the WTO, the World Trade Organization. That's the big problem. Our big problem is not with Mexico and Canada. It's with China, among others. But in any case, yeah, go ahead.
I have one more question. Do you think this homegrown Terrorist Prevention Act that I think has passed the Senate now is a blatant attempt to impeach our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, and dissent?
I don't think it's a blatant attempt to. I think that may well be the consequence of it. If you're talking about the one that basically defines thought crimes, it's supposed to be just a commission that investigates this stuff, and let's hope that that's where it stays. But it's not a piece of legislation that I support. Andre, thank you very much for the call. Kate in San Diego, California. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Hey, good. You know, I really liked what you just read, and are you going to post that on your website? It made me proud to be a liberal.
We can do that.
Cool.
Yeah. It'll probably take an hour to get up there, but we'll do it.
Yeah, because a lot of what you're saying and a lot of what I'm hearing is kind of reminds me of the 60s, you know, and how important an era that was, and it just feels like there's kind of a revolution going on, and I'm not referring to Obama.
It's about every 30 years you have these revolutionary periods in the United States. It was the same in the 1930s. It was the same in the 1900s, you know, with Teddy Roosevelt and the Republican Revolt, essentially. It was the same in the 1870s and during Reconstruction. It was the same in the 1850s leading up to the Civil War. It was the same in the 1820s or the 1812s, you know, the war, the British, the War of 1812 and that whole era. And it was 30 years earlier than that is the American Revolution. It's almost like every generation has to learn all the lessons all over again.
That's exactly what's going on now. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I called because I'm really disturbed by the polls in Texas, because I've been making calls for the past week, and every time I make calls, I've made over probably 200, 250 calls. It's 3-1 Hillary, and I know they've been sending us on this automated system into different parts of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, where are the polls coming from? Inner city? I don't know.
I don't know either. You're making calls on behalf
of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And that's what surprises me. There's very little mention of Obama. Now, I've got some hang-ups, so maybe those people are Obama people just pissed off to be called by Hillary people, but I got the sense more they were Republicans that hate Hillary kind of people.
Interesting.
But I also don't know if you heard anything about this, that Obama sent somebody up to say something to Canada, like, don't worry about the rhetoric I'm using in Ohio. Did you hear any more about that? I heard
that this morning
on one of the MSNBC.
Yeah, no, I didn't, Kate. And sort of
like the doublespeak that he's not supposed to be a real politician, but
yeah.
I guess they were denying
it. Kate, your partisan stripes are showing. I'm going to leave it at that. No, I haven't. In answer to your question, no, I haven't. I haven't heard that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have been bashing NAFTA. I think, frankly, that their vitriol should be directed toward the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and the World Bank. That's a much bigger piece to chew off, whatever the appropriate metaphor is. Hey, Caleb in Portland, Oregon. What's on your mind, Caleb?
Hey, good morning. You know, about 3 months ago, remember Gambia, I think, started providing fertilizer for its citizens. For the farmers, and that really, really worked, and it proved that the World Bank was wrong.
That's right, and they did it in defiance of the World Bank, which was trying to force neoliberalism on them.
Right, and geez, it worked so much better than letting these farmers kill each other and not export. Now they're a major exporter for the first time in years.
Yeah, well said.
Know, Tom, another thing, I contributed to the Darfur account. I went to your website and did that.
Oh, great. Thank you, Caleb.
And I want people to, if you want to pay with a credit card, put in the information first, and then the second screen will allow you to put it in your credit card. But just go through the first screen, and it'll get you to the second one.
Right. And there's a top link just to give it to that charity. It's Christian Solidarity International. And I'm not representing that charity. In fact, I am a little uncomfortable with a overtly religious charity. But the fact of the matter is that everybody else has fled the country. Nobody else is doing the work in country, and they are. And, you know, God bless them for doing it. And I will go in there with them and be taking these sacks of hope, this food with them. Yeah.
Hey, Tom, God bless you too, sir.
Thank you, Caleb. Thank you very much for your kind words. David in San Mateo. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. Hey, have a good trip next week.
Thank you.
Regarding tariffs, did you see 60 Minutes, the segment on Ohio yesterday?
I did. Are you talking about the health care one?
Well, Steve, they touched on various issues about the economy. And Steve Croft asked both Hillary and Barack if we should raise tariffs to protect American workers.
Yeah,
did you see that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
They treated it, both of them treated the question like it was radioactive.
Right. Well, the T word is radioactive right now, and it has been ever since, largely ever since the Clinton-Bush debates in the 92 election. It's just the prevailing wisdom. I mean, the Milton Friedman School, the Chicago School, and Tom Friedman and his books, The Olive Tree and the Lexus and The Earth is Flat, have so indoctrinated so many Americans that they are just terrified to use the tariff word. And tariffs is what we need. I mean, tariffs is what built this country. Tariffs are what, right now, Korea is using to protect their economy. It's what Japan is using to protect its economy. It's what China is using to protect its economy. It's what many of the European countries are using to protect their economies. And in fact, two articles in today's Financial Times about this. This is Japan, huge, full-page story, full-page analysis in today's Financial Times, page 7. Headline, one-way street, as its companies expand abroad, Japan erects new barriers at home. And then they talk about this guy, Takao Kibatata, as the top bureaucrat at the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. He says companies should be able to choose their shareholders. In other words, the Japanese companies are saying that they will not allow people from outside Japan to buy into their companies. Although it signed the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades in 1955, as recently as the 1980s and 90s, Japan was frequently locked in the battle with trade partners over market access for products ranging from U.S. oranges to insurance policies. And then basically what they're saying is that these sovereign wealth funds or even private companies or wealthy individuals from outside of Japan, they don't want them in. They just do not want them in the country. They want to make sure that the Japanese economy is owned by the Japanese. Again, quoting today from today's Financial Times, last year the government expanded its list of sectors in which foreign investment of over 10% in a company must be sanctioned by a regulator on the grounds of national security. The Trade Ministry recently extended its review of an application by the Children's Investment Fund, a UK-based hedge fund, to increase its stake in J-Power, an electricity wholesaler. Now you see, they're saying, no, you can't buy into electricity. You can't buy. And what are we doing? We're selling our roads to the Spanish. We're selling our power plants to the British. We're selling, or to the French, rather. We're selling our water supply to the French. We're selling our entire retail sector to the Chinese. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bobby and Eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue. Mind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there, chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and took his car. Just another poor boy off to find a rich man's war.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Well, it's coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a heads up, Dr. Louis Malmadrona will be with us at the top of the next hour. And right now, Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Talk Radio News on the line with us. And hey, Ellen, in the first hour of our program, we had Joe Madison on for about 20 minutes.
Oh,
great.
Wow.
Having a nice conversation with Joe, who's going to be traveling with you and me to Darfur or to the Darfur region, southern Sudan, next week.
That's right. Wow, that's pretty cool.
I'm sure you saw the front page of the New York Times on Sunday.
Could I miss it?
Yeah, the top solidly third of the entire front page is this god-awful, horrible picture of a burned village. And over on my website, I've got a link to the movie, TheDevilCameOnHorseback.com, which is the best documentary on Darfur I've ever seen. It just came out. It just won a bunch of Sundance Film Festival
awards.
And
you can watch it on the web, correct?
You can watch the trailer on the web, which gives you a good sense of what it actually looks like there. And you can buy the DVD on the web for, you know, whatever. I don't know how much. It's not very much. And there's also a list of theaters where it's screening. But when you saw the article in the Sunday paper, what was your response?
Well, my response is that it's a mess over there, and it's scary, but all the more reason why we ought to go, because I think that the American public doesn't hear the story very much. Certainly they don't on most airwaves,
yeah,
be it television or radio. And I think that we as talk hosts, and we're going with, as you know, both conservative and liberals.
Yeah, Rusty Humphries is, hardcore conservative, and I'm as liberal as you get, so here we are.
Right.
And Joe's in the middle, I guess.
Exactly. And so I think that that it's a good thing that we can all tell the story.
Yeah. Joe said that he had on a member of Congress who literally just got back day before yesterday from that exact same region that we're flying into, and that they are concerned that civil war is about to break out in southern Sudan, separate from Darfur, as a consequence of the peace accord not holding. So it's we all have to keep our ears on the ground.
A little dicey.
Yeah, yeah. But
as I think you and I have talked about on the show, I was in the coup d'etat in the Philippines. I think we were in two separate coup d'etats in the Philippines.
I was there when Ferdy Marcos got thrown out.
Yeah, and I was there with in 1989 when Bush 1 sent over the planes and all
right.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, we both have. I was in Albania and Macedonia during the Kosovo War, and
yep. I was in Venezuela during the coup. I was in Thailand during a coup. I was in Egypt when Sadat was shot.
Oh my gosh! knowing our record and our luck, I have a feeling we're going to be there from some. May you live in interesting times is a Chinese proverb.
Yeah, there you go, there you go. So anyway, what's going on in Washington D.C.
Well, Mr. Paulson, who's the Treasury Secretary, he made an address this morning at the National Association of Business Economists, and he said that their efforts and the industry efforts to help homeowners with the mortgage issues are making progress. Now, I don't know what he is citing. But apparently, he said, well, 93% of American homeowners, 51 million households, pay their mortgages on time. He said only 2% are in foreclosure. But as you know, that is in the millions.
2% of American homeowners is a hell of a lot of people.
Absolutely. But we have a homeownership of, what, 68 or 69% now, something like that. It's pretty high.
Right, and there's about 140 million families or households in the United States out of the 300 million population.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, that is, wow.
It's very, very significant.
Yes.
Now, this is also another interesting one. Just as it's like, as if $3 a gallon isn't terrible. Apparently, when the reporter last week asked the president about Bush gas prices ranging to $4, and he expressed surprise, the National Economic Council director said, well, they expect it to go to $3.60 for gas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but $3.60 is a more than many, many families can afford. And how, I mean, yes, it's 40 cents cheaper than $4 on the gallon, but it's not much to say.
Yeah. And now the Republicans are saying if the Democrats pull out of Iraq, that the price of gasoline is going to go up, as if to say, oh, well, we invaded there in the first place to get gas. But wait a minute. Before the invasion, gas was $32 a barrel, and now it's $100 a barrel. And I think that there might be some sort of a correlation between those two things, don't you?
Exactly. The other thing is today, Secretary Gates was looking at the NATO troops, and he thinks that there needs to be more troops in Afghanistan. There is going to be, by the way, a NATO summit in Bucharest on April 2nd to the 4th. So that is going to be top of the hit parade. And also, lest we not forget the Ohio primary, there was apparently this incident where one of Obama's staff persons assured his name is Goolsbee, and he told the Canadian consulate officials in Chicago to take the NAFTA criticism with a grain of salt. Hillary folks absolutely came at it full force. Howard Wolfson this morning on a conference call said, let Mr. Goolsbee be available for a full interview.
Interesting. Yeah, we had a Hillary Clinton, you know, partisan caller raise that topic, and I was not aware of all the details of it. So interesting. So it actually happened, and apparently.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, apparently it did actually happen, but whether he was sanctioned by Obama or not, Obama's people fully denied.
Right. Okay. Well, then I think we should probably take the denial at face value. Fascinating. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow, and we'll see you next Tuesday in Zurich. You bet. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. The smart people get their news.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and with me in the studio, an old and dear friend, Dr. Louis Malmadrona, MEHL-MADRONA, the author of Coyote Healing, Coyote Medicine, a number of books, PhD, MD, professor of medicine. You and Andrew Weil at the school down in University of Arizona. You were out on the East Coast at what was the hospital you were?
It was Beth Israel.
Beth Israel Medical Center. And now you're a professor of medicine and a practicing psychiatrist up in Canada.
Right, at the University of Saskatchewan.
And teaching medicine there as well.
Right.
And it's always great having you on. First of all, you're here in town because you're doing a gig here. So for the folks who are listening to AM 620 KPOJ, when and where is that?
It's at the New Renaissance Bookstore tonight around 6:45, I think we start.
Great. Okay, great. And we'll mention that again before we wrap this thing up. And Lewis, you have practiced and taught medicine in the United States for the better part of a couple of decades anyway.
It's been 32 years since I got my MD.
Wow. Yeah.
So I'm getting old.
Yeah, a couple of old farts here. And you know, you and I have known each other for at least a decade and a half, it seems.
That's right.
A long time ago that you invited me to participate in a Native American healing ceremony that you were leading. You're Native American.
Right.
And you are now teaching and practicing medicine in Canada. What, last night, 60 Minutes did this amazing piece on a charity called Remote Area Medical that typically goes into third world countries or worse and sets up, you know, 2 and 3 day, you know, emergency medicine. You know, here we are, people have never seen a doctor, people are not going to have an opportunity to see a doctor, you know, diagnostic and treatment facilities. And they did this instead in Knoxville, Tennessee. And people drove from hundreds of miles around and sat in freezing all night long to get in line, and they were absolutely overwhelmed. I mean, the state of American medical care, for anybody who makes less than fill in the blank, I don't know what the amount is, but somewhere between $40,000 and $70,000 a year, the state of American medical care is not unlike that in a third world country, or worse. And that's not the case in Canada.
No.
Can you quickly describe for us what it is like in Canada? You know, you teach there. You teach medicine, you practice medicine, and presumably you're a consumer of medicine, medical services in Canada. What it's like, and what it would take for the United States to make the transition to a Canadian-style system?
You know, probably the simplest thing is that nobody worries about how we're going to pay for anything. So as a patient, you just go to the doctor, and you don't really worry about how much it costs, and you just hand them your card, and they bill for it, and that's that. And as a doctor, we don't really worry about how you're going to pay for it either. We just do what we think is best, and that's that. What's amazing going to Canada from the U.S. is that no one ever asks what kind of insurance you have.
Mm.
No one ever questions whether or not you can pay for something. And people get what they need. And yes, sometimes they wait for elective surgeries because there aren't enough operating rooms, or sometimes it's because there's not enough surgeons. But if it's an emergency, it's quick. And, you know, there's no such thing as what's called utilization review.
Mm-hmm.
When I practiced in the U.S., someone from the UR department would come see me every day to try and kick people out of the hospital, try and get my patients out of the hospital because they were costing money. Or if I wanted to admit someone to the hospital, they would refuse. They'd say, well, you can't.
We see these shows like House, you know, here in the United States, which is supposed to take place, I think, in Princeton Medical Center. And he goes, well, order an MRI, get a test for this, see if he's got that, check. And in reality, he would be, would you please find out from the insurance company if they'll pay for an MRI, and then
That's
call
right.
the, you know. So
exactly.
It is so, it's such a twisted view of medicine. What we're seeing in our TV shows is medicine as it's practiced in Canada or medicine as it's practiced in Europe. Yeah, but they're taking place in the United States. It's bizarre.
It is. And, you know, Canada has its problems, and we still order too many lab tests. We still spend less time with people than we should. You know, it's less severe than the United States, and I can tell you why. Because in Canada, as a family physician, you can bill for every 15 minutes that you spend with a patient, whereas here, as a family physician, you're capped. And so
you can only bill for the first 15 minutes.
You can only bill for for the first 6 minutes.
Really?
So that's about how.
After that, the insurance
too.
Companies won't pay for it. And that's
right,
why the docs
right.
try and get you out of the office as fast as they can.
Because
after 6 minutes, they're not being paid anymore.
They're not being paid anymore. So now in Canada, if you see people every 6 minutes, you can still make more money than if you see them every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you as a family physician, you would make about $40 for a 15-minute office visit. But if you can do that in 6 minutes, you still make $40.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you probably make about, I'm guessing, $30 for an office visit. And so if you see them every 6 minutes, well, you're still making enough money to pay your overhead. Mm-hmm. But you can, in Canada, choose to see people every 15 minutes. You could see the same person for an hour, and you would make the same money as if you
and bill as it as four 15-minute segments and get
That's
paid
right.
for each one of those segments.
That's right. That's right.
So then I can hear conservatives all over America screaming, oh, my God, people who just love to go to the doctor's office are just going to come in and talk your ear off, and I'm going to have to pay for it. It must cost a fortune.
Let me tell you about that, and I'm going to use an American example. Hmm. I have a friend in Scottsdale who has what's called a concierge practice, and she's a family physician, and she limits her practice to 250 people. And each of those people pay her $2,000 at the start of the year. And they can come see her as much as they want. They can see her for as long as they want. They never have to pay another penny. Hmm. And what she found was that people see her a lot less than she wants them to when they can come as much as they want.
Yeah.
And people get tired and want to leave sooner than she's ready to stop the appointment.
Really?
Yes.
So the reality is there's this whole myth of the people who want to take advantage of the system because it's free is nonsense. There may be some small 0.001% of the, you know, people who are compulsive about having stupid surgeries or things. I mean, there is a medical
right.
condition there that you probably know the name of and I don't, but that's the exception.
Right. I mean, it's really not a lot of fun to go to the doctor, actually.
I never thought so. I mean, I like it when you come and stay at our house like you are. You know, so say, hey, Lois, what do you think of this thing on my arm? You know, but that's about as far as it goes. I mean,
that's right.
Who wants to go to the doc? You know,
that's right.
No offense.
Well, and every study that's been done shows that if you give people the time that they need when they need it, they actually consume less resources over the course of a year.
Right.
It costs you less to take care of people when they need.
Both because of preventative care is being done right and because people just generally have other things to do than go hang out
right,
at the doctor's
right,
office
right.
that they'd rather do. Interesting. And if the United States was to make this transition to a Canadian-style system or a more European-style, a more single-payer kind of system, what is it that, and we have about a minute and a half left here, what is it that we would have to change structurally or psychologically in the United States in order for that to happen?
People would have to change the idea that they deserve every test immediately right now. A quick example, I know someone in Anchorage, Alaska, who 54-year-old woman, smokes a couple cigarettes a day, doesn't exercise, high stress, had chest pain, went into the ER. Now, the logical thing to do would be to make sure she's not having a heart attack and schedule her for a stress test, you know, treadmill test where she
right.
walks on the treadmill.
And also perhaps make sure that she's not having a panic attack.
Right. What happened was she went straight to cardiac cath, which cost at least $20,000.
Now, cardiac cath is where they put a long tube in the femoral artery, as I recall, and snake it up into
snake
the heart.
Snake it up into the heart.
And do this all under x-rays. And this has a certain rate of death associated with it.
It does. It does. And
9 out of 1,000, I think?
Not death, but some kind of stroke.
Strokes.
Strokes. Yeah, 0.9% in one study. So here's a risky procedure that could have caused her many problems, that cost $20,000, that really wasn't necessary. And
there was nothing wrong with her.
There was nothing wrong with her. And after she was done, she was so grateful to them because they definitively proved that there was nothing wrong with her.
When instead of a $20,000 very dangerous procedure, it could have been a $30 test, a blood test that would show whether the enzymes
well,
were there
would,
of heart
a treadmill
damage.
Test would probably be more like an $800
test. $800
test. But if you pass your treadmill test, your chances of having a heart attack in the year are minimal.
Yeah. So tonight here in Portland, you are at
New Renaissance Bookstore
at 6:45. Great. Lewis, Dr. Lewis Melmadrona, and your website, Lewis.
It's no W's, just Melmadrona without the hyphen, .mysite.com.
MELMADRONA.mysite.com. Thank you, Lewis. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Weak or strong, it is known to scream.
21 minutes past the hour. And just once again, for those folks who want, in the Portland area, want to check out Lewis, his new book is Narrative Medicine. Just came out. And he'll be at the new Renaissance Bookstore here in Portland. It's on Northwest 23rd Avenue, 1338 Northwest 23rd, from 7, more or less, to around 8:30. So, strange things out there on the proverbial wire services. Yes, George Bush asked about the red phone campaign ads. This from our own private wire service here. I say, President George W. Bush commented on Senator Hillary Clinton's controversial red phone campaign ads at the White House today, telling reporters, quote, "When that red phone rings, I just let it go straight to voicemail." Mr. Bush rarely comments about the Democratic presidential contest, but he said that he had to speak up about Senator Clinton's red phone ads because he found them so confusing. Mr. Bush said, "If I answered the red phone every time it rang, I'd never get any sleep. Sometimes it starts ringing at 9 p.m., and I'm already tucked in by then." Mr. Bush said, "There's nothing so important I can't wait until tomorrow or whenever I remember to check my voicemail." In a rebuke of Senator Clinton, Mr. Bush added, "If she doesn't know about letting your calls go straight to voicemail, I don't think she has the experience to be president." Campaigning in Houston, former President Bill Clinton took issue with Mr. Bush's remarks, telling reporters, "When I get a call at 3 a.m., I always pick it up, if you know what I mean." Pressed to explain exactly what he meant, the former president said, "3 o'clock in the morning? Come on! Odds are we're talking about a booty call." Shortly after his booty call remark, the Clinton campaign said that they were revising the former president's itinerary to focus on states that had already voted in February. Elsewhere, Senator John McCain released a new series of campaign ads showing him answering a telegraph key at 3 a.m. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for his marvelous wire service stories and the permission to use them here on the air. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chip in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Chip, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
A couple weeks ago on Bill Maher, he had Tom Brokaw, and he was talking about the 1968 election where there was a lot of enthusiasm, similar to that there is now for Obama, for McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
And that when Humphrey got the nomination, everybody just kind of went home.
Yeah, I saw that. And you know, I'm just not sure everybody's going to go home this time. You know, I remember the, you know, get clean for Gene and all that stuff. These are different times in so many regards. In one way, it's a different time for younger people that is not quite as severe because there was a draft back then. Now, on the other hand, it's a different time in that everybody's getting whacked economically. Everybody has been terrorized by this terrorist administration that we have here. I call the Bush administration a terrorist administration very advisedly. I know the right-wingers will go hysterical about it, but the fact of the matter is, as Tom Ridge pointed out after he resigned from his job as Director of Homeland Security, that during the election of 2004, he was told by the White House to raise the security alerts at times when he didn't think it was appropriate, apparently for political purposes. You've got an administration that has used terror for political purposes, and that's one of the definitions of terrorism. I think that you know, given that we have a terrorist administration and terrorism is going to be one of the main things that's used against the American people by the Republicans, that the times are different, and that whether it's Barack Obama or whether it's Hillary Clinton, in either case, we're going to have a candidate who's going to stand up to that kind of fear-mongering is the word that everybody likes to use because it's a soft way of not saying terrorist, just like they say, you know, authoritarian rather than fascist. I just assume, you know, just call it what it is. Rick in Woodland, Washington. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Oh, not much. I just wanted to bring up, during the Reagan recession,
yeah,
there was a saying going around in the circles that I travel that it's a recession when your neighbor's out of work, and it's a depression when you're out of work.
Yeah, and that's where we are, and for a lot of Americans, we're in a depression. You know, good point and well said. Catherine in Los Angeles. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. As I told the screener, my sister just finished a course of chemotherapy in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho,
mm-hmm,
and was told at that clinic that all the Canadians come down there to have cancer treatment. And I was wondering how we could bounce that off your previous guest and try to see if that's true and why.
It's a vanishing hitchhiker story, Catherine. I lived in Vermont for 10 years, 2 hours from the Canadian border. Every weekend, Americans would fill a bus, mostly elderly Americans, and drive up to Canada for medical care and for prescriptions. And one of my very best friends was a doctor, a physician in Montpelier. She was on the board of Physicians for National Health, PNHP, whatever, Physicians for National Health Policy, I think it is. And in fact, I was the keynote speaker at their address in San Francisco as a result of knowing her back, this was 8 years ago. We never saw a Canadian. Now, it might have happened. You know, it could be somebody came down for plastic surgery or something. But
right.
I never saw a Canadian in Vermont. And I lived in central and northern Vermont for 10 years. I don't believe it. These are like the vanishing hitchhiker stories. Oh, yeah, my brother-in-law knows somebody who, you know, sorry. What you have is third world medicine in the United States. First world medicine, the rest of the world. 27 minutes past the hour. When we come back. Karen Ackerman from the AFL-CIO. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof. Pay for a drink if you gotta have proof. Distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
Now, increasingly, Americans can't make it here anymore. And in large part, that you can track right back to 1981 when Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor in the United States. The political director of the AFL-CIO, Karen Ackerman, is on the line with us, AFLCIO.org, of course, their website. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. If John McCain were to become president, what sort of economic activity, what would the average American see as time goes on?
I think in the unfortunate scenario that you've presented of John McCain becoming the president, I think we'd see more of the same Bush economic policies. I think we've had 8 years of economic policies that benefited the wealthy, that you see shifting tax breaks, shifting public monies to the wealthiest people in this country while working families are basically at a standstill. Their safety net for working class middle income families are is falling through, and they see their jobs outsourced. They see trade deals that benefit only the very wealthy and the corporations in this country. So a McCain economic program will be absolutely more of the same of the Bush administration program.
Right, more Reaganomics on steroids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we see now under the Bush years really such the biggest income inequality that we've seen in many, many years. And in fact, we know that 1% of the wealth, 25% of the wealth in this country is owned by 1% of the wealthiest people, the same as in 1927. So the gap is getting much, much bigger under the Bush policies, and these are the same policies that McCain espouses.
Right. Now, on the Democratic side, we have two candidates, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. From the point of view of the AFL-CIO, or from your point of view, how are their economic records and platforms different?
I think either of these candidates would be enormously different. The constituencies are different.
You mean different from each other or different from the Republicans?
No, I think different from McCain and different from the Republicans. I think their economic policies basically would be the same, and part of what we have to do as a labor movement, as the AFL-CIO, through our political program for the next 35 weeks, is really to define the issues and to make sure that the issues of economic security, the issues of labor law reform, making it easier and more possible for workers to have a union and bargain collectively, issues of health care, universal affordable health care, for everyone become the dominant issues, that the economic issues become the dominant issues in this campaign, because the economy is what's on people's mind. And so I think whoever is elected on the Democratic side, or whoever is nominated and then elected as a Democrat, would then really need to address these issues of economic security.
We're talking with Karen Ackerman, the political director of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. And Karen, correct my memory if it's wrong, but my recollection is that Card Check, the Employee Free Choice Act, the ability of anybody to basically unionize their workplace if they can get half of the people who work there to vote for it, to check a card, actually passed the Senate with a majority, but was filibustered by the Republicans because there weren't 60 votes. Is my recollection correct?
It was passed overwhelmingly in the House, including all the new Democratic members of Congress, and a number of Republicans voted for it in the House, passed overwhelmingly in the House. In the Senate, it was filibustered, and since there were not 60 votes to override a filibuster, we were not able to have a vote in the Senate. So,
right. But there would have been more than 50 votes, wouldn't there?
Yes, there would have been more than 50 votes.
So the question, and I don't mean to beat up on Harry Reid. I think Harry Reid's a very good and decent man, but he doesn't seem to excel at political theater. What is it going to take for us to get the Democrats? Because I think this is an essential thing. You know, without a strong labor movement, we got no future for the middle class in America. And what is it going to take for us to say to the leadership of the Senate, it's time to do that political theater? Let's bring the Employee Free Choice Act forward again. And if the Republicans are going to filibuster it, have them stand there for the next 4 days, shut down the Senate, and let them tell us why unions are a bad thing.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that we as progressives need to do in building a progressive movement, not only in the labor movement, but the progressive movement in general, is really to make bargaining rights and the ability for workers to be able to organize and bargain collectively a central issue in this election. And we also, as progressives, need to expand the majority, not only in the House, but certainly in the Senate as well, of progressive senators like John Tester, like Amy Klobuchar, like Sherrod Brown, who really are economic populists and will stand with working families. And we need to elect more of those folks so that the whole dynamic of what's discussed in the Senate and the House and throughout this country changes on behalf of working families.
Yeah. Is the AFL-CIO taking a position on our trade deals?
The AFL-CIO, yes, does take a position on all the trade deals, and we are firmly committed to, as you know, making sure that there are environmental and labor standards in all the trade deals. So we look at each one of them to see whether the standards are in fact there, and we need to do a lot more in this country to really invest in the infrastructure in this country, create jobs, not export jobs, not create trade deals that enable corporations to make more profits, but really invest in working families in this country.
Okay. Well said. Karen Ackerman, the political director of the AFL-CIO. The website is AFLCIO.org. Karen, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Okay, thank you.
It's been great talking with you. And you just marvelous work you're doing. Please keep
thank
it up.
You. Bye-bye. Thank you.
866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Sandra in Oakland, California. Hey, Sandra, what's on your mind?
How are you today, Tom?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
I'm going to be sending you some money for the Bag of Hope, and have good luck in Sudan.
Thank you.
I mean, I think we all live in interesting times. It seems to be all of our curse. But
yeah.
I wanted to say, I've been thinking for a few years about, I'm the one that did the little video, and it's going to be up soon. I'm an American, and I'm not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of
what
Americans.
What a great phrase.
What?
What a great phrase.
Thank you. You said you liked it when I told it to you last time, too. And I have a bunch of other people saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And I could go into that, but I have so many things I could talk to you about. You have to come to dinner when I have you and Gore Vidal and all the my other favorite people.
Okay.
But anyway, I happened to see this little video right before I left this morning, came to work, made by Emily Kunstler. I think
mm-hmm.
it's K-U-N-T-S-L-E-R, but I just saw the credits really quickly, so I'm not positive. But what she did is she stood at a payphone in New York City and put the phone number of the White House comment line and videotaped people and had quarters for people to pay for it and videotaped people doing this and calling the White House comment line, which I do almost every day, just so you know. And it made me so enthusiastic that I called, too. And what I asked them is, what happens to our comments?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, they're sent to the appropriate office. And I said, what office is that? Well, we can't tell you. And I said, you work for me. I'm the American public. Where does it go? And they kept, you know, hanging up on me. I kept calling back. Finally, I reached somebody who was new who, and then they, this weird guy came on, I swear was Homeland Security with a southern voice. And he basically said, you know, well, we pass it on. And I said, well, I asked him to repeat back what I said, and he couldn't do it. Well, we don't do that. I said, it's because you either throw it away then, or maybe you're recording us, or, you know, and then we're in the conversation that we were happening. He said, because we record you. He actually said those words to me. And then I called him on it, and he said, I didn't say that. I meant recording, like writing it down. And I said, no, I don't think it, that's the kind of recording.
I guarantee you, if you call the White House, it's going to be recorded. And actually, you know, I think that you could justify that, because if some, you know, people, we've had enough presidents assassinated in the history of this country.
I was making a point, but the reason I'm saying this is because I also called CNN last week and said, I want to know who made up that poll about Obama. I think we need, I think this is a great new kind of protesting that I've been looking for.
Yeah.
I think we need to call the White House and ask them questions about it. Like, and then we need to call CNN and ask them, who is responsible for making that poll about Obama? We want to know. I mean, I said maybe we should have a poll saying if people are interested in finding these things out.
Yeah, it's a good one, Sandra. And we'll have to put the White House. We have Congress's phone number over at callcongress.org. We'll have to put the White House's phone number on that same page so that people can easily do what you're doing. Good on you for your activism. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm reading Coyote Wisdom by Dr. Louis Madrona, and he's talking about in there how when two or more people pray together, their prayers become more powerful, and it generates an energy field. And he said modern research shows that increased coherence among brainwave patterns happens.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking
there's actually a biological and scientific basis for that. And it's not just prayer, it's even thinking, you know, it's yes.
He said if the same people do the same ceremony week after week for years, a great healing power is created. So I'm thinking, why don't we do this on a national basis or even a world basis and try to heal the planet and
our
moral compass?
There you go. Jackie, you know what we're looking at here coming November? We're looking at a national exorcism. We're going to cast out the demons. I mean, that's it really is. I mean, you get right down to it. That's a great way to think of it, is we're going to do a national exorcism. We don't need the Catholic Church to do it, although if they want to participate, it would be great. But they have official exorcists, I guess, or at least did at one point in time. And I probably a lot of Protestant denominations as well, and other religions too. We need to exorcise the demons. Good one. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
We'd settle for that. Be a great start. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry McAuliffe on the line with us. February 2001 was elected chairman of the Democratic National Committee and Convention Party. DNC. What does DNC stand for, Terry?
Democratic National Committee.
Committee. That's what I thought. Thank you very much. In any case, you did a marvelous job as chairman, and you're out there these days now, I believe, as a Hillary surrogate, by and large.
Chairman of the Hillary campaign.
Chairman of the Hillary Clinton for President.
I love these chairman titles.
Yeah. Are there others?
I've had a lot. No, I love the Clintons, most expensive friends I've ever had.
Yeah. Okay. Terry, after the Ohio and Texas primaries or elections...
Yeah.
Regardless of the outcome, do you think that the party will be a more or less united place as a party?
You mean after these contests tomorrow?
Yeah.
No, I think this domination's going to, I think Hillary wins here in Ohio where I am right now. She wins Texas.
she wins Rhode Island. And then I think all eyes probably go till Pennsylvania. They all look to April 22nd. But, you know, I remind you that Bill Clinton did not win the nomination until June of 1992. John Kerry.
Well, hang on just a second. When was the first primary in 1992? What month was it held in?
Yeah, well, I was about 4 weeks later. But it went on much longer. John Kerry won the nomination. We had an early system last time, and Kerry won the nomination March 10th. So, I mean, listen, we got to let everybody vote, but we're all going to be unified at the end. The good news, Tom, there are literally 5.5 million more people have come out and voted in the Democratic primaries and caucuses than the Republicans. That's good news.
I agree.
We have a good, healthy debate, and then at the end, everybody comes together.
I agree, and I am not taking a partisan position or a I don't know if partisan is the right word because we're all in the Democratic Party here, but I'm not taking a position on this. I want the voters to be heard. And however the voters go, I will support that candidate, whether it's, as I told you when you were here in our studio about a year ago, I will, you know, whether it's Hillary Clinton or whether it's Barack Obama or anybody else. I mean, it's down to those two now, but you are a super
delegate. You also said you got some of the nicest studios in the country.
Yeah, well, thank you. You also, you're a super delegate. And
I have
taken the position all along that superdelegates are actually a good thing, that they're about 20% of the people who are going to make the decision, and that the Democratic Party is essentially a giant club, and that if I'm a longtime member of the club and I really have given my life to the club and I'm part of the club, that I want to make sure that there are at least some of the people in the club who didn't just join yesterday and who may leave tomorrow, that their voice maybe just doesn't have quite as much weight as somebody who's been in the club and given their life to the club. And that's why I think that the superdelegates, looking out for the interests of the party, both short and long term, are actually an important and useful thing. There are a lot of other people out there saying, no, you know, 20%, that's too many. We should cut back on the superdelegates. I'm wondering, as a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, what's your take on this?
Well, and don't forget, Tom, you got to add to it, a big piece of this was every member of the Senate and every member of the House, Democrat, these guys are going to be on the ballot. So these aren't just like people who've been involved in the party.
Right. The vast majority of the superdelegates are actually people who are elected. And so even though they're not elected to represent a particular presidential nominee, they still are answerable to we the people. Yeah.
And they're going to be on the ballot. Many of them are going to be on the ballot. So this came in just as a fail-safe in case someone got started moving along, and all the people who actually, these members of the House and the Senate, who were the ones who actually pushed this, as well as governors, that they had some say in the nominee. And that's where the genesis came from. It's also DNC members who work for the party every day.
Right.
Then a very tiny group of former presidents, vice presidents, former speakers of the House, former Senate leaders, and former DNC chairs.
Right, people who've been in the club for the long, people who've given their lives to the club, essentially.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
So it seems to me like a good thing. I'm curious what your personal opinion is about the future of superdelegates, what it should be.
Yeah,
on behalf of the Clinton campaign.
As long as I've been involved in helping the party, and I've been out for 30 years helping the party, you know, the superdelegates have always been around. I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. You know, listen, the rules are the rules. The Republicans have winner-take-all.
Right.
And if you know that if we had winner-take-all today, Hillary would about have the nomination wrapped up because of the gigantic stakes that she has won.
Right.
So, you know, listen, you've got to take both sides of this thing. The rules are, and let's get through Puerto Rico on June 7th. Let's get everybody out there voting. I just don't think, I think it will come to a conclusion, and it's not going to be this gigantic train wreck that the Republicans are hoping for.
Well, I think, you know, we hold our primary here in May in Oregon. So if I get to cast a deciding vote in the Oregon primary, I will not object. Terry McAuliffe, who do you think would make great VP choices for either of these two candidates?
Well, what I have always said is, listen, we were never presumptuous enough to think about a VP candidate. You got to win this nomination. I said from day one, Hillary Clinton is going to have to earn every single vote. They've thrown the kitchen sink at her, which is fine. She's running for the most important job in the world. And I've known Hillary for 25 years, Tom. She's going to pick someone who she feels could become president if anything happened to her. And second, is compatible with her views. She's not going to do it for geographic reasons or political reasons. She's going to do someone who she thinks will continue on with the policies that she believes are best for America, which is all he can do. But in fairness, none of us are looking at the VP. We are focused on getting this nomination.
Yeah, no, I agree. Although there's a lot of us out there just loving to speculate about this stuff, scratching our heads. Terry McAuliffe, by the way, your most recent book, we had you on about it. Give the book a plug.
Well, great. Yeah, it just came out in paperback last week. It did great. It made it to time
and the,
before.
And the title is?
What a Party.
What a Party. That's right. Thank you very much. Terry McAuliffe,
right,
his new book,
down.
What a Party. Keep up the good work, Terry. Tomorrow, Chris Hedges, Willie Brown, your calls, the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.